and just like it's almost like my life was going in reverse, and I was just looking back on all these people's front porches I had slept on, or in the woods, and you know, eating out of trash cans and stuff. I just wasn't thinking about all that kind of stuff. And now God has a ram in the bush for me, and now this is finally over.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
We're live.
Good.
Oh, boy. Shifting gears.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome, 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 welcome. Mostly welcome to most of you. And for the rest of you, welcome to the Most High Show, made for and by people in recovery. It's a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. It's real people, real stories, and real life. This is the Most High Show. All right, today we got a new little setup.
Yep,
we do. I'm back on the show. My name is Christian. We got Kim on the ones and twos and Sarah on the ones and twos. Katie's doing quality control. We got a whole squad out there watching.
Oh, yeah.
We got an in-studio audience. And our guest today is Jason. And he is here on his final day of his internship here at Most High Media. So let's welcome Jason to the Most High Show.
Appreciate you. Appreciate you a lot.
So Jason went from a year of homelessness to working in film, mentoring others, and living a purpose-driven life, all in over 17 months being sober. So this is going to be a pretty interesting episode.
I feel so.
We're going to kind of let it go, see how it goes. Yeah. We're going to just talk. In a second, we're going to forget the cameras and the lights.
Right.
And it'll just be me and you discussing and talking. And hopefully those who listen will get something out of it. And that reminds me, how about a prayer?
Most definitely. Too.
All right. Divine Source, we recognize your presence in our life and how you show up in each of us and through each of us in our own unique ways. We offer this time to your care and control, and we trust that this will find the eyes and the ears that it needs to. And it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right. So let's just start at where you're at today. You're ending this internship and what you're stepping into. And I'd like to establish where our guest is today.
Okay.
Before we go back.
Right. Before we go into
the nonsense.
Okay. Where am I today? Currently, I am working multiple jobs. I'm working with Choice Recovery, a program that I graduated from and became an employee through Nancy Houston. She's the CEO, CFO of Choice Recovery. David Cleope, he's the director of the program. And now I'm doing resource coordinating for the program currently. Also, I'm working with Nancy at Choice Education, doing her transcripts for that. And I'm also working with Crew One Productions as a stagehand.
Okay.
And I'm working on my clothing line.
All right.
So that's where I'm at.
So you're transitioning that. And today's your last day at the internship.
Yeah.
So tell, what have you been doing at the internship and what that's looked like? Because you've been kind of doing all four of these things.
Doing here at the internship?
Yeah.
Oh, where do I start? Well, I started with, I always like to really plug the important things before we get into what I was doing. I love to really put out that the fact that Most High for me is doing something that has not been done. You never go to a job, or you've never been in a situation where getting sober is, and staying sober is your main objective about what you're doing. You know, I tell everyone about this. You get coaching, counseling, and training. Those are the three things that you get on any other job that you may get. Don't get me wrong. The job is the job, and that what you do for them is like always going to be like main priority for what you do. Here, the job, most definitely you have to do the job, but you being sober is the number one goal here that Christian maintains, he and David and just the team overall,
that, because it's an internship.
Yeah,
right?
It's an internship. Right. So never get that screwed and mixed up with the job either, because they're two different things. But it prepares you for jobs or a job in general. So what I've been doing here, working on merchandise. We've got a lot of different apparel, summer and winter apparel. We've got, I worked on that. I think I started with 2024. I did the rough cuts for Montana 2024. I did that. What else? Hosted a couple of shows. Learned the ones and twos, audio, video. We went to Montana for 2 weeks. Yeah, which was a dope trip. What else? What did we do? I learned how to coexist with addicts, crazy addicts, most definitely. Dealt with that, me being included. Built a really good team here. That was really cool, really dope for me. I grew a lot, faced a lot of different battles. Had some mountains I had to climb for myself. Went back home, dealt with personal stuff. When we did the footage for the documentary, we've done a lot of outside outreaches too. You know, we've done a lot of that stuff, reaching out to the community and giving back and depositing back into everybody. So yeah, as far as work wise, it put me back in a space where I felt human, because when you're in sober livings for so long, you feel a bit institutionalized. You feel like a person, but just not a whole person, because you're a person that someone has to tell you what to do and how to do it and how long to do it and take you here and take you there. So when I came here, I had started driving because I was blessed. Someone gave me a car. So I ended up being blessed with the car. So I was driving back and forth. So that gave me like an insight on just being a little bit more human and in touch with myself about being free again. And so when you get here, Most High is, it's a place where you're not supposed to fit in, but you do. It's a space where no matter what your gender, orientation, color, what do you believe, whether politics, just anything in your life that's different that you feel like you don't have to agree with everybody about, you can come here and really just chill out and just get some stuff done and just grow as a person. This is my thoughts on it.
So, yeah. Beautiful. Well said. We're going to clip that. And we'll use that at the end of the year giving campaign. See if we can raise some money with that.
Sick of him. You see, this is what I deal with. 6 months, this is what I deal with.
But it wasn't always growing and learning and expanding and taking advantage of opportunities that come your way, right? And you've said that your addiction started with opioids. Yeah. And when you think back, and I like the way you look at your time in addiction, because you don't see it as kind of black and white. And a lot of like us in recovery, it's kind of like, it's like a line, like a proverbial line of like, okay, here's this line of when I was addicted and everything back there. Mm-hmm. And then this line, now I'm sober.
Right.
And you can kind of see the complexities of your life in active addiction, mm-hmm. that there were God moments, there were moments of love, there were moments of light, and those moments of extreme darkness.
Right.
But do you remember, and I don't think we've ever talked about this, do you remember when drugs really became a solution to you? Like really when it solved the problem that you were dealing with and you really felt like, oh, this is where I kind of want to stay for a while. Do you remember the first time you experienced that?
Okay, so
Munda, make sure you keep the mic.
I'm working at this place. I was working at 1888 Meals, right? I had a homegirl named Crystal Seth, I'll never forget. And I keep in mind, drugs wasn't like a thing. I smoked a little weed, you know, here and then. Back in my days, it was reefer, it wasn't weed. So I smoked a little reefer back then, did a little drinking here and there. But I'm working in this factory, and I was a machine operator. And so her and I were dating two brothers. She was dating one, they were both from Honduras. She was dating one guy, and I was, her and I was dating the same guy.
Okay.
That's what it was. Okay. Let me make sure I put this in here right. The plot thickens. Let me do this right. I got to do it the right way. That's the truth. I was thinking about the brother, because the brother was cute too. But we were both dating the same guy. Now, she didn't know that I was sleeping with him, but I knew she was. So we worked on the same machine. And so the brother, some kind of way, had some pain pills for a toothache. And so we working on the machine, and I had a toothache that day. And she was like, the guy's name was Elano. She was like, Elano got some pills in his bag. So keep in mind, I had never taken a, it was a hydrocodone 10, I think, at the time, baby blue. They were huge back then. So she went and got it, and she went and got it. So I was like, girl, what is it going to do? You know? And she's like, just take it. So me, stupid, I'm like, yeah. Popped it. So I'm running the machine and I started getting really warm. it started kicking in, and when it started kicking in, I was running the machine like I'm pushing out, because we were doing rally towels. We used to do like rally towels for football games and stuff. So I'm got the machine wide open, and it was a feeling of, I was like, I see why white women love these pills. Yeah, I'm like, I see why white women, because you can take them and people don't know you high because your eyes are not red and you're not disoriented and you're not sweating or anything. And you now, can just.
Not everybody has that response to.
No.
Right? Some people take it and they go to sleep. But there's some of us, like, my response
not me.
To, I want to be creative. I want to do lit. Shit.
I was, the last thing was sleep for me. Oh, yes. No.
So you were turned up, yeah, and really working on this machine.
Oh yeah, it made me believe that it amplified who I was times 10. That's what it felt like. So of course, it's a brand new drug. It's not like it's not a violent drug. So I'm like, shit yeah, I'm finna keep doing this. So the next day, keep in mind that one lasts me all day pretty much. So the next day, of course, I'm like, girl, go get us another one. And so she go gets us another one. Lord willing, I think by the end of the week, we had knocked a hole in that boy pill bottle. We were taking them, like me and Hunter were taking them on a regular basis. So back then, pills wasn't just a thing in my town or my neighborhood. It wasn't a thing like it is now. Older women just had them in their cabinets. And so I've always just been really cool with everybody. So if I had like an older lady I was cool with, I like go holler at him like, girl, you got some pills in your cabinet that you, cause, and all of them would say the same thing. Oh yeah, I got them. They've been there for 2 years, or they've been here for so and so amount of time. And they were like, well, you might not want them. I'm like, yeah, let me see what you got. And so it started with that, just kind of getting them for free. Well,
so this is what you're saying, like it's before there. It's hard to think that there was a time before this opioid epidemic.
It was never, it was nowhere near that.
Right. Mm-mm. Because I remember the same thing, getting a surgery and being prescribed big bottles and kind of an unlimited, endless supply. And that's kind of the start of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It never, just like you said, it was, it just was something that no one really, it was almost like a hidden secret, almost. It felt like it was, because you would be surprised, or I would be surprised, how many people had been sitting on this stuff for so long and not just getting high as hell off this stuff.
Right.
Older people, of course, it would scare them, so I understood why they weren't taking it. So I just kept going and kept going. Well, then I got with one of my homeboys, and he's like a brother to me. And we started selling them, because people were starting to hear about it and this. And you couldn't tell the difference in me. My weight didn't fluctuate like me getting on heavier drugs like they would do now. It was a very normal life. I could go to work. I wasn't.
So what do you think that was doing for you during that time? Like, was it making life a little more interesting? Was it making funner? Did you feel like, oh, now I'm more, I can work harder? Or what's... what do you think it was solving for you?
Not a damn thing. It's just something to do. It never had I didn't have like some tragic thing going on. I wasn't in a car wreck or nothing. It was just
something to do.
I was at work, and who in the hell wants to be at work bored as fuck?
Right.
Excuse me. Should I be saying that?
Yes.
Yeah. I forgot.
Speak honestly.
I know sometimes we.
No, you should.
But
speak
you at
honestly.
Work, yeah. And it's like I'm at work, and work is work. Most of the time when you're at work is lame. Yeah. Work is lame, and so you got these 8 huge hours, or however long you got to work. You got these huge hours that you got to work, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning, 8:30, and I just got here at 7:45. So if I can pop a pill, the time at this point doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter. Like, we're going to kick it. We're going to talk shit. I'm going to be running up and down the line, doing this, doing that.
Right.
So it was never like just a reason for it. It just happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just happened.
Yeah. Now... transitioning from something like this that was fun and enjoyable and kind of enhanced your life. Mm-hmm. And I think most people, I don't know if it was to be even say most, but a lot of people, right, the first time, certainly for myself, like getting into drugs and alcohol was a social thing. It was fun. It wasn't really heavy consequences, you know, and it's like it's good until it's not.
Right.
So what was the turning point in your drug use that you felt like, oh, this is now that you look back?
Okay.
Looking back now, you feel like, oh, you kind of crossed this threshold to where some of, like, I would say darkness kind of was being entered in. Do you remember that?
Are you asking me when I graduated from Appeal to something different or when Peels became?
Yeah, I mean, when did drug use start to get a little dark? Where it wasn't quite so fun and enhancing life and it was starting to steal from life.
Okay, this is when you end up being like a stone cold fool and you just will do anything for it. That's what you're asking me.
Yes. Thank you.
I can't remember the I can't really remember the exact moment when it happened.
Yeah.
I just know I had to have it. And I had to have whatever it was, whether it was pills, because I think I ended up graduating from pills to cocaine. So, well, no, I graduated from pills because I went from taking pills to, like, snorting pills. So then I went from snorting pills to cocaine. After cocaine, I think it was just a little bit of, like, meth or something. Meth and pills, and then they were kind of back and forth with it. Meth was boring as shit to me. Like, you know, people were like, meth be making you want you, like, get you somebody and just get you a motel and just bang it out. I would never like that. It didn't do that for me. Meth was just, oh my God. I'm like, what in the world? I don't get this thing. And I guess I didn't get that thing because I had not found my thing yet.
Right.
Because you can find your thing if you keep going. So, end up graduating to smoking crack. Now, Lord, no.
Now, was there any apprehension to going to, to crack?
Nope.
Not like a it stigma never was to associated me. With it or like, oh, no, I'm not going to do that?
Well, the only stigma I think that people put on crack cocaine is like people, for some reason, drug dealers tend to look down on crack smokers.
Okay.
So I don't know why, because it's not much of a difference between crack and cocaine. I think it's like a couple of ingredients that separate the two, maybe baking soda and water or something. But for the most part, someone that's, like, in my neighborhood, crack is like, if you're a crackhead or a junkie, then you just almost like you have leprosy or something. Mm. You're completely different from every other drunk or addict there. It's like, okay, for some reason, people believe that addicts, it's levels to being to being an addict. I guess it's like, you're a bougie addict if you're just, like, snorting cocaine. But if you're smoking crack, you are below average on every single thing.
Well, like, back in I feel like two fucking uncles talking here. Back in my day, you know, but... The line was not putting a needle on your arm.
So never did that.
So it was like, as long as you weren't putting a needle on your arm, you were like not that far out, right? Like, you could be doing wild shit, but if you didn't put a needle on your arm, you weren't that, you weren't a junkie.
Right,
that's how it used to be, like, you know. When
once you take it there, it means, okay, you just went off the deep end.
Right.
I never peeled, needles there in Thomason was never a thing, but it was this real cute guy named John, and John used to like cocaine, and so me and him, we were trying to hook up, but something kept happening where we couldn't, and he didn't. He was going to do it with me, but thank God we never did.
Right.
Like, we ended up just doing drugs together, but it was like the regular normal way. So thank
but
God.
But I think it's important to set the stage of, like, you keep kind of saying, like, where you grew up, and we're really close to finishing your documentary, where we went to Thomaston, or better yet, Lincoln Park, and we filmed where you grew
I like
up.
How you plug that did
yeah
too.
Because, like, now I have this visual representation of where you grew up.
Yes.
And, you know, you hear about the hood and you hear about the projects, and this is kind of unique, especially for me, like, growing up in California, right, because you have this very rural area and there's this neighborhood kind of in the middle of nowhere that is impoverished, right? That doesn't have resources in it,
correct?
Right, and so drug use, drug dealing, crime, everything going on in this area is not, like, regulated, It's kind of a Wild West.
Yes.
And it's a giant subdivision, right?
You summed that up really well.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it is. It's like he was saying, like, it was the Wild West, because in this, it's like a city inside of a city. And this is something I said to him. And one day when I said this to him, it grabbed Christian during this conversation. I said, in this neighborhood, you can get everything but some help. You can get your car fixed. You can get a babysitter. You can get food. People cooking, selling plates. You can get your hair done. Everything that you, no matter what it is, it's there. And on both ends of this huge city neighborhood are two stores that sell alcohol on both ends. And so when I'm describing this to Christian before we went, I couldn't really give it the that it needed. I needed for him to see it. Yeah. So I tell him, I told him, I said, when we get there, we just let you bust a block. Let you bust a block around, and I just need you to see it. And so we did. And Christian, he's super dope. So he ain't one of them white boy that kind of paranoid about that kind of stuff. You see what I'm saying? Because the normal, and this is no disrespect to anybody in the studio audience or that's watching in general. I like white boys too. So the thing is, he was just, it was very comfortable and normal. And I say this, I've said this to a few people. Man, when he and I were like shooting footage, somebody came up and sold some dope right in front of us, didn't they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With no, and he didn't panic and fall out, and it was like, whoa, and all that. It just wasn't a thing. He's used to seeing that kind of stuff. And so the neighborhood, to give everyone like an overview or just a little glimpse at why I keep referring to this neighborhood in this way, it is a space for me where I was destined to die. I knew I was going to die. I'm 250, almost 260 now. I was 144 pounds during this time. And I can remember never just figuring out how to get out. Like,
you know, went to get crack, that meant you went a block down the road.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you didn't have to go a block down the road. Right. It's on every corner. Like, it's the front side, the back side, and the middle section to this entire neighborhood, and it's different dope bars for every section. So most of the time, and I know that people from this area will watch this.
it's like for normal people who go to hit Publix for some peanut butter. I mean, it's that convenient.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah,
very much so. It's where my mom's house, where I had lived for years and years. At one point in time, if it wasn't a crack house across the street, it was like a liquor house or a little juke joint where you can have access. Like, the candy lady sold cookies, pies, candy, liquor, beers, and single cigarettes, that kind of stuff too. So it was just that type of thing. If it had something to do with any type of drug paraphernalia, you can get it. And I'm not talking about you can get it 2 hours. You can get it in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And you can get it in the next 10 minutes after that 10 minutes too. Yeah.
I think that's important to understand that, like, for you to graduate wasn't a huge leap for you to jump to that. So you move on to crack, and that's, do you feel like that's when kind of there was some darkness? That's when there was some chaos?
Not yet. Sorry about cutting you out. Not yet. Because I smoked crack for a whole entire year, and I realized that I was smoking it wrong. I was smoking crack like a cigarette. So when I hit the pipe, I just blow the smoke out, not knowing I need to be trying to keep the fucking smoke. And so I didn't know. It's just the truth. I did for a whole year. I think back to how much money I wasted on a year smoking crack the wrong way. Keep in mind now, I'm running with some real crack smokers. I'm talking about these people. They vets in this stuff too now. They vets. They know what's going on. And I know they climbing me in the head too. Like, but I know what they were doing. I was a brand new crack smoker. So I had cash.
Yeah.
So they didn't give a damn about whether I would get high or not, because I was just going to splurge anyway. Because number one, I'm smoking crack. And I'm not, most definitely not doing it at my house at this moment. Now, I'm not that comfortable. So I'm going to the crack spots. So number one, it's like they're already saying to themselves, oh, you smoke crack now? And I've never been ashamed of nothing I've done. I've never hid anything I've done. Most people, when you do, they do certain things, whether it's me sleeping with a guy or whether me sleeping with a girl, because I had my moments when I did that too, still do when I feel like it. But whatever drug I did, I never hid anything I did. Because what was the purpose of hiding something and trying to do it? You weren't going to enjoy the high. If I got to be sneaking and geeking, the geeking ain't going to happen. So I just did what I did. And so they didn't tell me, because if I'm going over your house, let's say, for instance, I call you and I'm like, hey, Christian, I got X, Y, and Z. I got a gram. And you smoke crack, too. Now, you a vet at it. Let's just say hypothetical. And right. People watching, he does not smoke crack. Okay. Let's just make sure we clarify that he does not smoke crack. But let's say that he, at this moment, he did. So I can smoke at your spot. So, of course, if I smoke at your spot, this is how it went. Whoever the house lady and the house guy were, you got to put them on anyway. Right. You got to, if you smoking dope at these people high, you can't come with dope and not break them off. You got to break them off top. So by the time I were to come and break him off, then I'm smoking and I'm blowing mine. Because keep in mind, now he may be smoking, he over there high as a kite. I'm talking about acting a fool. But I'm trying to figure out, like, why the hell I'm not where he at?
Yeah.
Well, that went on for a year. Until I finally one day, it was one night a year later, and let me say this too. This may be a bit controversial when I say this, but I believe that the reason why I ended up, because I stopped, but I went back. I believe that when I went back, it was because God felt as if I couldn't tell anybody the truth about it if I had not really done it. It may sound crazy to everybody about that, but I felt like he was rerouting me back down that road. And I know people are like, God doesn't tell you to smoke. No, it was, it's not that thing. I just always have believed that
you can't. So there's a verse, I think, that okay. It says what you're saying.
Okay.
And it's a Bible verse.
Mm-hmm. Bad me up, friend.
Not to be controversial with the Bible, yep. Quoting the Bible.
We know. We know.
Lord knows.
Uh-huh.
All right. It says he handed him over to his sin so that he may acknowledge the errors of his ways and return back.
That's what I'm talking about. You cooking with grease, friend. I love it about you.
So you're being turned over to this thing so reprobate. That you can return.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because to continue to kind of try to save you from this and save you from this. And we experience this with people in recovery, right? Where you're trying to help someone who wants to get sober but doesn't really want to get sober. Mm-hmm. And so at some point you kind of have to let them kind of what we would say go to rock bottom or make come to that conclusion of themselves.
You have to.
Right? Like I can say I'm an alcoholic, but I can't say you're an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. You have to come to that point.
Right.
And I think the verse is saying that same thing, and that's maybe what you're
agree.
Saying.
I agree. Completely I agree. By the way, and he does know what he's speaking about. He is a ordained pastor. Mm-hmm. If you don't know.
No,
now
I try
you
to
know.
Tell people that.
I want you to know. I want you to know. Seminary school and all. So
I try to keep that secret.
Yeah. He shouldn't. I'm gonna brag on him a bit too before I go back to where I'm at. He is far more than what you think as far as just the owner and the soul. What is it? How would they say it? Is it sole proprietor? How do you say that?
The CEO.
The CEO of the nonprofit of Most High. And he is fantastic at music too. And hopefully when people hear and see the documentary that he just spoke to me about that we may kind of plug once this is over. He's a beautiful musician. Great.
That's
dad.
How he tricked me to edit his documentary because he put my music in it. So it's like a 20-minute, it's like a 15-minute music
video.
He's
telling
basically.
Lies on me already. He was all for that shit. He knew it.
Yeah.
So,
he's like, I want to use your music. I'm like, okay, yeah.
But
edit it.
And it real talk though, like, His music puts me in the moods I need to be. I tell him all the time, Christian's music puts me in the mood that you want to be in when you high and you on dope without being on dope. Y'all know what it is. It's like, what they call it, nostalgia. You know what I'm saying? Like when you know you going, you riding with your homeboys or with your old lady or whatever, and you play this song, but you know both of y'all smoking weed and doing what you're doing. And it's that feeling in between what's going on. Christian's music gives you that without the... you going to jail or going to fucking prison behind it. You see what I'm saying? You got to steal the money and shit for stuff like that. So you're good to go. But what was the question?
So things get dark.
Okay.
You inhale. You didn't inhale. Right. Now you inhale.
Right. Okay. Okay.
And you're turned over to this place, this darkness. So I don't want to dwell too much on the dark times. Okay. Right. Because I love that we're getting into the details, but we know what drugs do, right?
Right.
They take us to a place, mm-hmm. and there is a point in your journey where you go, I don't want to do this anymore. And I think you said this in the documentary, which is, it kind of came down to dope or God.
Right.
So let's fast forward to this point of like you making, because this is a big, especially like being down and you're living in this mm-hmm. zone, right? To make a decision to say, I want to get help.
Mm-hmm.
That's like climbing out of a hole where everyone's kind of pulling you back down. What was that decision you made and going to the hospital to get help?
Okay. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to hit back a little bit and pivot.
Okay.
So I'll go to the drug thing I didn't complete. Well, I went back down that road, and that's when I started getting high. Really. And when I went down that road and started getting high in a substantial way, that's when I was exposed to the truth of it, the savage parts of it, the evilness in it, the all the negative, just the poisonous that comes along with it. And so I thank God for me being able to do that, because down those roads and down those valleys, it is some really, really hurt, broken people. Like, you see, when you can hop me for me, when I was in the place to get high that I was, it's some really good people. It's not, they're not bad people. They're just stuck. They're stuck, not only stuck in the drug, but they're also stuck in these situations and in this town and in this city where you can't get help. So I can remember being with people that we would get high, but when we got sober, that sober version of them wanted help so bad, but by the time somebody showed up again with crack, they're back down that road. So that taught me how to be able, because I wouldn't be able to encourage and talk and uplift and deposit into people if I don't really know about what they're dealing with. So that's where I'll pivot to that. So you asked me, when did it get rough and the point where I knew I needed help? Okay. I knew I needed help from the beginning, because you always know, like, if you're a real addict and you know yourself, you know damn well you need help now. Even though you don't say it out loud, it's those moments of clarity that you be sitting around looking at yourself and you looking at your pants and they falling off your body and you can't really recognize yourself in the mirror. Now, you steady hitting that dope. You steady smoking or whatever you're doing, but you say, man, I look bad as hell. Now, keep in mind, no one around you is telling you the truth about you.
Right.
No one, not one single person is saying to you, bruh, you need to tighten up. No one. And if they are saying it, they're saying it laughing at you. They're not trying to really be in a concerned way. And so before I lost my home, I lost my mom first. So I lost my mom, which was hard. And losing my mom and then still doing drugs when I lost my mom, that's when I realized that mental illness and drugs were cousins or best friends, because you realize then that it's more to this than that. So I lost my mom first. I lost two aunts. I lost my best friend. And I lost another friend's daughter that I was very close with. So I lost five people. And I'm trying to keep maintaining like the place and the house I'm living in, but I didn't have a job. The reason I didn't have a job, because I knew that I was not going to be on drugs forever. And I was always the type of junkie like this, that if I'm doing dope, I'm not going to go over here on these people's job and try to get a job and quit. Because I know that when I get sober, for real, I'm going to need this job. Or I'm going to need this work ethic record. So I don't want to blow that. So I did the normal stuff that all junkies do, like steal, lie, con. I sold a little something. You know, I sold a little penis when I had to. Excuse me for saying that right now. I had to sell a little something. You know, just do your thing, what you do, just to maintain. But once I ended up being homeless, which was something I've never experienced in my life, reality sets in. So I started going backwards. I started stop smoking more, so much crack, and started back on weed. Because it would make me be a lot more sober, and I have a mind frame, okay, Jason, you got to figure out what to do. And so it seemed as if every single door that I would reach for with clothes. And I've always been a firm believer that closed doors doesn't mean it's over. It means change directions. And I did have some substantial people in my life that really loved me. I had a cousin that I lived on the streets, but I never would live with people. I was not one of those people that I was going to be like, hey, let me sleep on your couch. Because the way I was as an addict and as a junkie, I didn't bring my lifestyle to my people I love. Like my best friend, the one that I love with all my heart, Tasha, she, I wasn't going to go live with her. What I could easily, I could have like called her and told her, listen, this is happening. And she would have welcomed me with open arms, but I always avoid them. Because I don't want my poisonous life to seep onto these people, because these people are pure good people and I don't want to taint them with what I got going on. So I just be out there just roughing it and just doing what I have to do. And so for a year, I moved from spot to spot and figured it out. And that's what it was. So that final moment that it pivoted, I'll never forget. I went to this store. It was Miss Maddie Mae Pickard's store, and it was this girl named Shanidra Reveille. We call her Nene. She works in there, and she cooks. And I told her, I said, I wanted a pork chop sandwich. I had talked to one of my girlfriends, Afrida. She works at the hospital, and I had told her, I said, I think I want to get some help. And she said, well, I'm going to be working today if you really, truly want to do it. Because the only way for me to get out, because there are no sober living programs in Thomaston. There's no places that you can go. I've never even been to an NA or AA meeting. Any of this stuff. None of this stuff even exists. I never even seen a big book until I started on this journey I started on. So I went to that place, and this guy named Brent Carter, he paid for my food. She cooked and he paid for it. So I ate a pork chop sandwich and some fries, which was delish. So I ate that. And when I walked out the door, because I was like, you know how we do this. This is another addict and another junkie thing. You say, I need to smoke one more piece of dope.
Right.
Then it always, you know, right. We always do that. But I didn't. And this guy, Malik, was coming. He had this little boy with him. And I said, Malik, what you about to do? And he was like, nothing. I said, can you give me a ride to the hospital? Because that was the only thing that just dropped in my mind at that point. Let's go to the hospital. So I go to the hospital. He drops me off at the hospital, which was so kind. He has a little boy with him. And when I got to the hospital, just so happened, it was a high school friend of mine that she's always been a really sweet girl. Her name is Johnny Thursday now. And I want to say that she's a nurse practitioner, and she's always been really driven. And so when I got in there, she had on a white coat, and it was just good to see her and see how she's grown so much. And so when I got to the hospital and I talked to her, I said, listen, this is what I need. I said, I've been on dope. You know, I've been on dope, because everybody know what you do. I didn't hide nothing. I said, I need a couple of things. I said, I need to figure out how I can get some help, and I need for you to run every test you can possibly run on me. I need AIDS test, the whole nine, because I'm out there getting loose. So I ain't trying to get sober, and I got this on the back of my mind thinking that maybe it's a possibility that I could be infected with anything, because it wasn't just HIV I was worried about. I was just worried about anything in general. So they put me in this room, and this really sweet lady named Miss Carmen came in, and she says, Jason, I think I found you something. And then she said, have you ever heard of Riverwoods Behavioral Health in Riverdale? I said, I've heard of Riverdale, but I never heard of Riverwoods. And so I'm laying in the bed. I think by this time I probably hadn't eaten a real, real meal besides that pork chop meal in like days. And then I hadn't slept maybe in a couple weeks. And when she said she found me a place, I just felt this sense of relief. I did. I felt like, man, it's over. I had not gone anywhere yet, but just to be like, just laying in the bed, in the hospital bed, and just like, it's almost like my life was going in reverse, and I was just looking back on all these people's front porches I had slept on, or in the woods, and, you know, eating out of trash cans and stuff. I just wasn't thinking about all that kind of stuff. And now God has a ram in the bush for me, and now this is finally over. And so I think I took like a 30-minute nap. And it was just the best rest, because it just felt like this huge burden was off me. And the police officer, they didn't have ambulances in Thomaston. So they escorted me in a police car from the hospital to Riverdale, which is like an hour and some change. And That's where it started.
Wow.
That's where it started. That was the first day I was sober. I went to, believe it or not, because it comes with more than just getting sober, I say 10 days in a unit called Thrive. So I'm in a paper shirt and paper pair of pants.
At Riverdale?
Yeah, right. Riverwoods. Yeah. And I had on the little socks. And I used to call them magic mics, the draws they give you. they were made out of, like, y'all ever seen, like, they were like these little cotton draw, but they weren't even made out of cotton. They were made out of like a net or something. And I used to call them Magic Mikes, like all your little beatings would be right. And so,
what's striking to me about this is that you have what like a moment of clarity.
Yes,
I need help. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is then it's like, okay, here's someone that buys you the sandwich. Mm-hmm. Here's the guy that pulls up, that goes, "I'll give you a ride. Get in." You know, you pull to the place. Here's a person there who's saying, "Okay, come on," right? Who obviously is behind the scenes connecting. He's here.
Right.
We got a chance here to get him out. And it's kind of like all these pieces were kind of ready for you.
Yes.
And it was like what we say, like to crack the door of willingness. And all that was required out of you was just a little bit of willingness to change. And then here is this whole system that came and swooped you up and placed you in a safe place with I mean, I don't think they probably didn't take any money from you. They just kind of put you in there.
Well, I didn't have anything to give but me. That's all I had. And so the girls were very, very welcoming. Like one of the nurses, Ashley, her and I went to school together. We had grown up together. She came and they brought me like sneakers. It was a lot of love. My friend Afrida, which is like a sister to me, she was working. She came downstairs because she had told me when you get there, because she didn't think I was going to really do it. You know how it go when you have friends and your friends are, and she never, let me speak about her for a minute too. She never pushed me. Her and Tasha McCraney and Alfreda Wellmaker. Let me just speak about these two women. It's never been a time in my life that these women judged me at all. They just loved me, no matter what the version of me I was. If I distanced myself from them, but they would always find me, make sure they put money in my hand. They never questioned me about what I was going to do with the money. They made sure I ate, and they went on about their life. You know, they just always been it. So I do owe these two ladies, and I love them with all my heart, and I let them know this all the time too. And Afrida was like, "So are you gonna come?" And I told her, I said, I'll let you know I'm gonna come. And I had every intention of doing it, and she said, "Well, I'll be at work and I'll be on the fourth floor. If you come, have them ring me up and let me know that you're there, and I'll come down." And so I think that when I told one of the young ladies to get in touch with her, I can only imagine how she felt. And so she ended up coming out, and she stopped by the concession stand and brought me a couple snacks and stuff. And that was it. I ended up in Riverdale at Riverwoods and ended up in that Thrive unit. I stayed in the Thrive unit, and that's the mental part of it. I stayed back there for 10 days. And that's when I graduated from that part of the program, and I ended up doing a PHP IOP program in Riverwoods. And it came along with the lodging. So I knew that life was different now. I have 10 days sober because I've been in this Thrive unit in the bag with the paper guys and these pants on with these crazy people that I'm crazy with too. And so I'm sober for 10 days. And 10 days for a junkie is like a year. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
that's where I was. That's where.
And so you do this the PHP IOP program. You're there. How long were you at this?
So let me say this too. So this is because this will kind of glue some things in, it'll put a pin in something. Well, the day that I went to this hospital, I only had a t-shirt on my back, I had a pair of red shorts, no underwear, and some tennis shoes. That was the only thing I had. So when I got to Riverwoods, of course they swapped those things out for the paper guys and stuff, but when I went to the lodge, I didn't have anything. That was all I had. So I had to think on my feet and figure out what I was gonna do. So they had a donation box. That's where I started creating pieces at Riverwoods because they had a donation box. So I would go in the donation box and keep in mind, we couldn't have scissors. We could, of course, I didn't have a sewing machine or anything like that. You know that, because they wouldn't even, they didn't even want me to have a pair of scissors. So I had already taught myself when I was homeless, when I was moving the cushions from places, like the sofa cushions and stuff from the abandoned houses, I had taught myself a couple of techniques how to tie things in a certain way, and a ripping process that you only could rip it so far and it would still hold in certain places it needed to hold in, until this guy named Mark Grantley ended up giving me a hot glue gun. And so I would go down to Miss Tammy's house when I was living in this little outside like laundry room, and she had a socket in there, and I could plug the socket and the glue gun in and take the pillow cushions and then glue them like I would sew them. So I applied this same method when I got the box of donation stuff. And so I just started creating clothes here and there then too, because I still wanted to be stylish. I did that when I was a junkie. Like I was a junkie walking around in custom pieces, like a stone cold fool. But that was just my thing though. I didn't want to see it look bad because I did what I did. And so I just started being there and I stayed there. You only are supposed to be there for, initially, because it's PHP IOP, I think it's insurance wise, it's 35 to 40 days. It's supposed to be short, but just so happened when I was trying to find me somewhere to go long term, I had been pulling a lot of resources and materials and looking at different places and calling and see if they fit what I wanted to do. They noticed it. And so people were coming to me saying, well, Jason, what about this place? And what do you think about this place? Because I was giving my resources out to, I'd make copies while I were there. Because one of the ladies' name, what was her name? She was the admin there. Oh, can't remember it all bad. But she would let me make copies and I would pass them out to the other guests or patients. And so Shawnee Stewart Steele was the director over the program. Sweet, sweet lady. And that's how I met Latosmo. Latosmo wasn't one of my therapists there. She was the best, and we talked yesterday. Well, I end up passing out a lot of the resources, and they asked me, well, Jason, listen, we don't have this particular thing at Riverwoods. We don't have a resource coordinator. This is what's the irony behind the whole thing. This is how God does what he does. So they asked me if, and please, I hope and pray that these people don't get in trouble for what I'm about to say. They took me off the books. So on paper, I was no longer a resident at this program, but I still was there, because what they gave me, they created this job around me where I was a case manager and I could help the people in the program find long-term or short-term housing to go to. So I'm trying to figure this out. All I got is my cell phone, and it's an Obama whip too, by the way. It ain't like I got an iPhone or something like that. I had got an Obama phone from the guy at the Dollar Tree that had a little stand and stuff when they give the free phones out. And I'm helping people and calling different agencies in different places. And just so happened, I called this place called Jay's Place. Jay's Place, Alicia Jordan, at the time, she was Alicia Smith. This is Reeves' wife. Some of you may know her or know him. Well, she taught me, never met me. We never had met. So we met on the phone. She taught me how to do this particular thing, how to do case management over the phone. So we always kept in touch. And if I got in a spot where I was stuck and I couldn't really find something for somebody, I could call her and just lean on her. So she taught me this. I stayed at Riverwoods for 7 months. 7 months. And it just got to the point where I knew they loved me and they would do anything I needed and help me out, because they didn't pay me, but it took care of my room and board. Yeah. But I was like, Jason, you got to get your ass up. You got to get you a job, because you're older and you can't just stay in the place forever. And so I was there for 7 months. And then I ended up going to SLA in Duluth. And that was my next step. Everybody laughing you just know something. What you know, Harold? What you know?
I know about that.
So let's just do this. For the sake of SLA, let's just quantum leap past the conversation on them, okay? Because I don't want to put any dirt on anybody's name. That's not what it's about. But because one thing I will say, that it was different, but God allowed SLA Duluth to do what it needed to do for me and provide me a roof. I wasn't homeless again. So I stayed there for 3 months. And still working on my clothes and stuff there too. So just so happened, Alicia called me because I had not spoken with her in a while. And she said, how you doing? And Latazma called me because both of them were very worried about me being in SLA. And I was like, not so good. Because it was a lot of, and this is not me shading SLA, but just humanity in general. I was going through a lot of racism and homophobia there. And it wasn't that place because it's everywhere. And so she was like, we got to find you another place. Well, fast forward a little bit, and Alicia's husband, now currently her husband Reeves, knew Joseph Hicks. Joseph Hicks was, at the time, was the director of Choice Recovery, and they were really good friends, and he had not had one single person in the program. And so they were like, what do you think about this? So God Mob, his nonprofit, paid for 2 weeks for me to go there. So I packed all my things, went to Choice Recovery, and I was the very first guest or resident at Choice Recovery. I got there, I met Nancy Houston, which now I'm currently working for. And so the program was me, Joseph, and it was another guy that was a house manager, and it was kind of built around me because I was the first everything for this, the first person to get the job, you know, how we were going to do this and that. And we just started out, and I ended up... Joseph spoke to me about Christian, this guy named Christian Jansen, and he was trying to give me this, just like a little insight on what they do, which I didn't understand it and didn't really get it either. So he reached out to Christian to ask him about the internship and if he had it. And so I did two interviews. One with Brian Sheets. I love Brian. He's gone now. And I did the second one with Christian.
He's not dead. He just don't work here.
Yeah, he is not. Yeah, he's not dead. Well,
he gone. He's just not gone like forever.
I did the interview with Christian, and I thought that it went well. But from like later on, I found out that he didn't really want to. Not necessarily. I'm gonna bring this up because I gotta put you on the spot. Because I'm not gonna let him get away with this too. This is for everybody. Like I've got to put his ass on the spot. He didn't think. Well, he didn't. Let me say this too. It's not that he didn't dislike me. He just felt like I would be resistant to growth because we didn't know each other. So I came and I did two interviews, and then the third. It was like two on Zoom interviews, and then he invited me to the Friday night podcast to kind of get a feel of what it was and everybody get a feel of me. So we really both were checking each other's temperature. That's what it really was about. Because for me too, and let me say this too, viewers, sponsees, and just people that's trying to get into programs in general, just because you're an addict, just because you deal with alcoholism and drugs and mental depression, whatever you deal with, and you are going to a particular place, do not put yourself in a spot that makes you feel as if you don't have a choice just because you're who you are. The same way these people vet you and check your temperature, you vet their ass and check their temperature too, okay? Because everywhere that you go is not always healthy for you. And don't get in a space where, okay, because this is what you do, I need you. There are 1,000 places out there for you to go and get healthy. And you should be mindful about where you go anyway, especially when you're deciding to put your place, your body, and your soul with people that's supposed to help you. Yeah. So
it sounds to me like, again, like kind of from this decision in Lincoln Park.
Right.
And being kind of carried and the path kind of being laid out for you. Mm-hmm. Right. And what do you think... Like for you, like talking to somebody who's kind of in this place where you were, right, mm-hmm. where you're beginning their journey, they're beginning their journey and they're trying to figure things out. You know, it's kind of, to me, I think of like a collaboration between whatever God is and us,
right.
That there's a give and a take that's happening, mm-hmm. right? And people want God to do everything, but God won't do for you what you can do for yourself. Mm-hmm. God will do what you can't do for yourself. What do you think you did right during this time? Right, to lead you to this moment here, right, where you've begun to build a life for yourself and a foundation that now you're going to grow from. But before you built that foundation, what do you think you did right that you can encourage somebody who's in that space now?
What did I do right that kind of landed me here that I feel like as a human?
Because I know you give a lot of credit to God that God laid you the path.
Yes.
But what did you do right that helped you to get here?
Obey. That's the number one thing. Most definitely, I became very sensitive to what he was saying. So what I did, I stopped thinking and start doing more feeling, because my thinking is retarded. It is very unhealthy. It has proven itself to lead me to disaster in my entire life, to be set on fire and be a shit show. So the first thing, I think, if to answer it in a more plain way, I had to get over myself. I had to get over, I couldn't come into this feeling like that I knew anything. I had to step into the unknown for real. And I did this. And this may be something that you're looking for in this answer. Every single thing that was brought to me that I felt like I shouldn't do, I pushed myself and went and did it. So it's like when someone says, do this interview with Christian Jansen at Most High, I'm like, hell no. And when I heard that hell no from me, I went and did it. So then once I got the position, it's like, quit, because it doesn't fit you. And then something says, because I've always had the capacity to endure. I've always had it. And so every single time I would hear that voice, and that's the thing that with addicts that we forget, that when you're trying to get sober, your body is sober, but it's still that voice that's not, that's telling you you can't and you shouldn't. So the fact that I acknowledged that was, because I know God's word. The Bible says that his sheep knows his voice. So when I hear anything negative, or I hear anything that's not prosperous, or anything that's speaking death instead of life, I do the complete opposite. So that's what I did. Mm-hmm. Because you really don't, really, if you really slick got some sense, and you're a little bit of sense, we really just get up and take a shower and put clothes on and press play. We really don't have a lot to do with how this thing really go.
Right. Yeah. All right. So as we're landing the plane and okay. wrapping up the show, that's your camera there. So yes. If you're talking to someone who's out there in sick and suffering, mm-hmm. or just needs some encouragement, what are your kind of final thoughts, and what would you have to say to somebody there?
Oh, final thoughts I'm going to do two things. I'm going to give them a final thought and then just something else that I feel like they need.
Okay.
Final thoughts is to just keep going. Just never give up on yourself. Always know that no matter what, that God says to you that he will never leave you nor forsake you. Know that it's true. That when no matter how hard it is for you, and that you looked on your life and looked at all the calamity and the things that's happened, and it's bad stuff, you still have made it through, and he has been with you the entire time. So just trust in him, because no matter how my life has been, every single promise that God has ever promised me has came to pass. And once you realize that, God will do this. He will always send a ram in the bush that will give you two things. It'll build you a relationship and a network and a family, and it'll give you opportunities. And you just fall into it. That's it.
Amen.
That's it.
Thank you, Jason. It's been a pleasure getting to know you and hanging out with you these last 6 months. And really looking forward to staying connected and seeing definitely. Where your growth is. So let's give a round of applause for Jason on his first show. Thank you to all the donors and supporters who make this possible. And we are going to end this show and go out there and get Pepsi wasted, baby. Let's go.
Happy Halloween. Yeah, happy Halloween.